This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I have really the great pleasure of talking to Joanna Penn. She's a writer of many different kinds of books and also, for many people, a guide and guru for authors and writers of all different kinds to learn how to be better at what they do. How are you, Joanna?
Oh, I'm great. And thanks for having me on the show, David. I'm excited to be on.
Well, I'm excited to have you. I think, I've read your work for a long time, and I actually have linked to your site innumerable times. Your blog has been really valuable information that I've recommended to a lot of people. So I thought it would be really good to have a chance to talk to you.
Oh, well, thanks so much for that as well. And it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I think we both have been podcasting a long time and putting information out there. And it's always incredible to me in this sort of internet age how we can all meet each other, because I'm in Bath in England, in case people are wondering where my accent is from, which is in the Southwest. And you're Connecticut, aren't you?
That is right.
The
miracle of Skype allows us to talk at any length without having to worry about long distance phone charges. Which used to happen, used to prevent these kinds of things from happening. In fact, it's really one of the things that I thought was interesting, that I think all of this time that I've been reading your work, I did not even realize you were British.
And it's interesting. I mean, I can address that straight away, because when I started writing and self-publishing back in 2006, 2007, I was living in Australia. And, I know you have a global sort of publishing and writing focus. And basically, Australia has 20 million people. And I looked at the American book market, which has 360 million, and went, do you know what? I really think I should aim for Americans. So since I started on, my blog and Twitter and all of that, I've scheduled things in an American time zone in order to try and grow. And in fact, probably 80% of my business income is from the US and in US dollars, which, with Brexit and the weaker pound, is excellent. So it's a bit of global arbitrage in terms of aiming for the American market.
So you do a lot of different things. I think you should probably add some extra time to your life, because it's really hard to, I find it amazing to look at the number of books you've written, the number of podcasts, the number of blog posts, I just don't understand how you find time to do all of this.
Well, I think the first point is, when people say, how do you find the time? My main question is, I spent 13 years as an IT consultant. I used to implement accounts payable into large corporates, which is, if any of you are listening, a cubicle slaves, you kind of get how miserable that is. And it just wasn't creative. So I got to a point in my life where I was just so desperate to change my career. So one of the things is, I'm super driven. Like, this is like the best life for me. I love writing. I love publishing. I love meeting people online and podcasting and all this stuff that we can do now. So I think, for me, that being driven is a really big thing. And I do work quite a lot of hours, but then I love what I do. And I used to obsess about work-life balance back when I had a day job. But I think, when you have a small business and you love what you do, it can become quite all-encompassing. And I do have now 3 author brands, and I write fiction and nonfiction. And, I do struggle with balancing my various brands, but it feels like that's, the most fulfilling way to do things. And of course, I did do the first 3.5 years of this while having a day job, so it can be done.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that writers probably can gain from you as a guide, but also you as an example for them, that a lot of this has to do with desire and commitment, and what often people advise, like if you're a musician, the sort of classic, put in your 10,000 hours. But I think that that is true, that if you really want something, you have to work hard at it. But the working hard does not feel like working hard, because you are loving what you're doing.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say it definitely does feel like working hard, but I love to work on this. And I think that's the big difference. I think we all need, you know, work. I think work is a kind of human thing. And but the definition of work, the word work, it might just be something to do, something to aim for with your life. You know, even people who win the lottery want to do something, you know, with their life, or people, you know, who have millions of dollars still want to do something. So for me, that kind of desire of what to do every day, you know, I've got on my wall here, you know, have you made art today? Have you written 1,000 words? Are you one step closer? And that one step closer is to a body of work that I'm proud of in my life. And then coming back to the practice idea, I think this is so important. And for some reason, the writing industry sort of looks down on practice. But, you know, the traditional industry almost worships debut authors as gods, whereas it's kind of crazy, especially if they're a true debut author, although a lot of them, you know, are relaunching under another name. But, you know, you become a better writer by writing. So, you know, after 24 books, I'm definitely a better writer now than I was when I wrote my first book. And that's true of anyone who practices their craft. Of course, you know, I've got 1,800 blog posts as well. So, you know, once you've written a lot of words and you understand how this works, it does become easier. But you can certainly still challenge yourself around different things.
So do you, I mean, this is sort of a structural question, but, and I have lots of questions about how you balance the nonfiction and the fiction writing. But when you're writing fiction, do you feel like having had editorial input, just to your point of, you know, writing more books makes you better? But isn't it also true that having editorial feedback that you can then inculcate into your work will also make you better?
Oh yeah, and I have several edits on all of my books. I have different fiction and nonfiction editors. When I first started, I had a number of story edits on that first novel because writing, you know, you think you know what you're doing as a reader. You think, oh, I've read a lot of books, I can write a novel, and then you discover that actually turning what's in your head into a story, a coherent story, is quite hard. So it's actually a good question right now because I'm just about to finish my current novel. And I've booked my editor for a week on Friday, sort of 10 days time. And, you know, I'm so looking forward to her feedback because there are lots of problems with the story that when you get to the end of that sort of, I am so sick of this, you know, when you start writing a book, you're like, wow, this is amazing. I'm so excited. And then the reality hit sets in. And then, you know, I'm at the point now where I just can't work my way out of some of these plot issues. So absolutely, you know, even though I'm self-published or I run my own publishing company, I absolutely advocate professional edits. So I get story edits, I get structural edits, and then I have line edits, and then I have a proofreader, separate proofreader entirely. So, you know, I consider independent publishing, you know, my books have to sit on the shelf next to traditionally published authors. So I emulate the process of the traditional publishing industry. And we're very lucky these days. Well, a lot of people aren't very lucky, but a few years back, the traditional publishing industry, with its sort of mergers and acquisitions, laid off thousands of people in the publishing industry, editors, cover designers, and those people now work freelance. So we're very lucky now that we can actually hire people who have worked for big publishing companies. So the quality issue, as long as you're willing to invest in your book, yeah, absolutely, you can get there.
Right. And what you touched on just there is really important too. And that is the notion that you actually are doing both, you're being a writer, but you're also essentially running a publishing business, where you have to invest just as a traditional publisher would do. You're investing in your product, and your product is your book.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the problems that many authors who self-publish face initially, is that they don't really understand that. And in fact, I would say even traditionally published authors at this point have to consider that they are a business. Many traditional publishers will expect authors to do marketing these days. And of course, marketing is one of those dirty words that many creatives don't like. But, you know, in a world with a lot of books, you have to get the word out somehow. So if you treat your it's almost like I wear two hats. So this morning I did 4 hours of writing, which is actually about the maximum I can do in terms of fiction. I feel quite dizzy after 4 hours of writing, but I'm near the end, so I was quite excited. So I did my 4 hours this morning, and then I took a break, and then in the afternoon I do my business stuff. So and that includes everything from blogging, podcasting, interviews like this, accounting, doing that type of thing, emails, all the things that you have to do when you run a business pretty much anyone would have to do. You know, maybe you if you're a freelance writer, or even if you have like a florist, these same types of things happen in every business. And I think authors need to realize that if they want to make a living this way, then they have to do these things. Of course, if it is a creative hobby or they have a day job, then awesome. You don't necessarily have to do it all. But if you do want to make a living, and certainly a good living, multi-six figures, then you do need to take this seriously as a business.
Do you find also, though, I think this comes up at least for some writers, that they feel like they can handle the creative part. They can do the hard work of writing, but they're really not good at marketing, or they don't feel comfortable with the idea of putting themselves out as a marketed commodity, in a sense, or they're not good at the business part. They don't feel like they understand, and they don't really want to understand how the business works. So do you have people that, when you talk to them, who really are good enough writers to self-publish and be successful in business, but then they have to essentially hire more of the services? They have to outsource more than someone who feels comfortable doing it themselves.
Yeah, sure. And of course, I have people that I work with, obviously editors, as we mentioned, cover designers. I do have an accountant, but you still have to prepare things before it goes to the accountant. My first degree is in theology, or religion, and my second degree is in psychology. I don't have an education in writing or business or internet marketing, or you don't have a degree in podcasting, right? I mean, this is stuff we've learned when we needed it. And I first started writing and self-publishing back in 2006, before the Kindle, before any of this. So it's, at this point, it's been sort of 11 years that I've been learning this and sort of putting it out there along the way. So that would be the biggest thing. When people become, like you said, people who are good enough writers, that have presumably spent a number of years learning the craft of writing, going to writers' conferences, investing money in doing courses, and most writers have a whole bookshelf of books on writing, so they have actually learned the skill and the craft of creative work. So I say that the business side, business is actually incredibly creative. You are creating wealth in the world. You're creating, what I like about running a business is it brings more money to more people within our creative industry. So I'm paying my designer, I'm paying my website person, I'm paying my editors, and that, this money go round is sort of the lifeblood of the industry. With more and more people writing books, that's, to me, is so exciting. Is, this is how working with each other is a self-sustaining industry as such. But so the first thing is, yes, you can learn. For example, I have a book called Business for Authors that was written for those people who just don't know anything about it. And then the second thing is, like you said, do they want it? And that, to me, is the big deal. There are the average income for an author, this is traditionally published or self-published in Britain, is £12,000, which is what, around 15,000 to 17,000 US dollars. And to me, that is not a living. That's appalling. But that, to me, is a hobby. So people have to decide, what do you want this career to be? And then, what is your definition of success? For example, if you want to win a literary prize, that's not the same as wanting to make a six-figure income. And for me, like I said earlier, my whole drive was to get out of my day job and become, make a living with my writing. So for me, it really was more about the income, which is why one of the reasons I went into self-publishing or independent publishing, because I could see that you could make a much better living that way than working with a traditional publisher.
Right. But you have to, in some ways, you have to work harder.
Well, I don't think you can. I don't think it's comparable. I mean, I know far more independent authors who do this for a full-time living than I do traditionally published authors. They mostly have day jobs. So if you looked at, you know, yes, I have to work harder at my publishing business, but they have to work in a day job.
Well, that's true. So, right. I think people do self-select to a certain extent, you know, that people who are comfortable giving up the day job and having the drive to succeed as you do are going to be attracted to self-publishing independently, whereas others who may be less adventurous, let's say, or less willing to take that risk, because you do, you know, you've taken a risk by doing this. You've been successful, but you've, when I say work harder, in a way, I just mean that you have to take on more of the responsibilities than the writer who is publishing traditionally, because they are letting others do that work. And of course, as you say, that means they make less money for their efforts. But for some people, for some writers, that's probably okay.
Oh, yeah. And as we said, most writers aren't writing for money. They're writing for validation, or, you know, the kudos of being able to say, you know, I'm published by HarperCollins or something like that. But in terms of a risk, you know, I did this part time for 3.5 years whilst working, because I didn't want to take the risk of just jumping out the window. And I'd absolutely say to people, don't give up the day job if you're writing your first book. You know, in fact, my income only overtook that day job income 5 years after I left. So I took a big pay cut to leave to make a, you know, try and make a living with my writing. So, you know, definitely there are hurdles. But I also think this is the best time, you know, in history to be a writer and to make a living with your writing. As we were saying at the beginning, you know, I'm in Britain and yet I make most of my living in US dollars, but also my books have sold in 83 countries. And that's something that most traditionally published authors don't have, because most publishers won't license the rights to all of those different countries. And the way the world's going with the you know, the internet being pushed out to the rest of the world, the online internet sales, which started in America, are now moving out into these other countries. And this is in English, by the way. So these books are all in English and have sold all over the world. And again, we're so lucky that we're writing in English and that we've got this global market. And one thing I wanted to say to your audience is, if you have licensed your book to, say, an American publisher, maybe you've signed a US-Canada deal, maybe you've even signed, you know, a UK Commonwealth deal, you can still self-publish in Australia, New Zealand, India, South America, you know, the rest of the world. So I really advise people to look at your publishing contracts and then consider whether you could self-publish in these other territories, and that will add an income stream to your business.
So you've hit on something that I think is really interesting also, and that is, I think in America, probably more so than in other English-speaking countries, we are not as aware of the international possibilities as, for instance, as you are. I mean, I think that it may be because we live in that large economy, and also because ebooks in particular were more popular here at the beginning than anywhere else. But I think what you've hit on is really important, and that is a kind of education process for almost everyone in America. We all need to learn more about what is going on in other countries, and not just because it's of, you know, personal value, but I mean, I think there are other values as well. But it certainly makes sense, what you just said, to think about the power of self-publishing around the world. I hadn't really even thought about that.
Oh, yeah. And this is my big, you know, soapbox when I speak to Americans. It really is a sort of look outside the US. And I mean, or just look at Amazon. You know, whatever you think of Amazon, they really have transformed the book industry for many people in a good way, for many people would say in a bad way for the publishers, but for customers, for readers, readers love Amazon, and so do independent authors. So if you look at what Amazon's doing, they recently bought a Middle Eastern internet sales company. They've invested heavily in India. They have stores in Brazil, obviously in Australia. They're about to open warehouses in Australia and kind of take on the Australian retail industry, which for readers is amazing because a new book, a new print book in Australia is around $30, which is crazy expensive. And so the sort of the future of reading in Australia depends on bringing the price of books down, in my opinion, as someone who lived there for 5 years. So what is amazing when you start to consider what's happening in the world? I mean, if you look at, you know, the companies that are bringing streaming 4G internet to, you know, sub-Saharan Africa and Asia and South America, Latin America, these are amazing times. And I think the big thing is that the ebook growth or the digital sales growth in America has slowed because, you know, how can it grow as fast as it has done? You know, in some genres of fiction, for example, in romance, it's over 70% digital now. So there's not much room for growth. Whereas if you look at the Middle East or India, the percentage of online sales is under 1%. So if you think about what's going to change in the next 5 to 10 years, it's very, very exciting. So particularly in India right now, I'm very excited because there are, I think it's 3 times as many English speakers in India who are the middle class Indians who are educated and speak English. So that's a very exciting market. So I hope some of the listeners are like, oh, wow, I could do this and go and check your publishing contracts and see if you've signed World English over to a publisher, you won't be able to do anything. But if you've only signed certain markets, then you can.
Well, and the other thing you could do is even if you've signed world rights away, you can go back to the publisher and say, are you exploiting those rights in the following countries? And if they say no, then potentially you could say, well, let's see if we could do a little renegotiating of our deal.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is audiobooks. I don't know if you've talked about this, but audiobooks now, you can independently do audiobooks with ACX.com, which is, again, Amazon owns Audible, which is the biggest audiobook company. And you can go on there as an individual or a company. And if you own the rights to your audio, the audio rights for your book, you can go on there, find professional narrators and put your audiobooks out there in the world through Audible, iTunes, your website, however you determine. And that is incredible. That's a new revenue stream that's really come online in the last couple of years and is one of the biggest growth areas. As you know, people who listen to us on their smartphones, a lot of podcast listeners kind of graduate to listening to audiobooks as well.
And there is, and also, I think the growth of audio, principally because of Audible, is going to spur some innovation. I think one of the things that's held back a lot of audiobook production is simply the cost of producing professionally. You know, hiring a voice actor, taking a studio, you know, has made the cost, the traditional cost of audiobooks too high for many books that might otherwise be made into audiobooks to have that done. And I think there's some technological innovation being spurred by the growth of Audible and the growth of audiobooks in general that may change the landscape over the next few years.
Oh, definitely, because now it's being seen as a profitable revenue stream. You know, people are now starting to bring in the different technologies that really help us. So, you know, for example, in the independent publishing space a few years back, or when I started, there wasn't even the Kindle. And then when the Kindle came on board and people started getting into it, there's more and more services that, you know, are supplied to independent authors. Audio now is starting to get that way as well. There's starting to be a sort of marketing side to audiobooks. And, you know, I would suggest, because I have fiction and nonfiction audiobooks, but I've made more money from my nonfiction. And I think that's because listeners to nonfiction audiobooks are less sensitive to how long they are. So someone will buy a, because most Audible listeners have a monthly subscription. And with fiction, the price or the, you know, the value of that fictional audiobook has to be more than their subscription. But with nonfiction, books are often shorter and they're not so worried. So I found that my shorter nonfiction books, like How to Make a Living with Your Writing, do incredibly well on Audible, even though they're quite short. So the cost of producing them was quite low. And I just I just pay professional narrators and keep the rights. You can do royalty split deals, though, if you want to, which is what I've done with my fiction, to keep the costs down.
Where you split a royalty with the voice actor, the narrator.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Yeah. That's interesting. So, well, to go back to self-publishing advice, because that is one of the things that you're very well known for, and I was going to ask you to talk about how things are changing, but you've already done that in some ways. When you advise authors, let's say starting authors, are you mostly talking to people who are writing fiction, or is it a mix of fiction and nonfiction?
Oh, it's definitely a mix, probably because I write both. So I can kind of advise on both. And, you know, I just tend to share my journey. And I actually started out writing nonfiction. My first book was called Career Change. And, you know, it was about trying to escape the day job and find something you love. and, you know, it's interesting that book now over the years has made me around $10,000, which isn't very much money, but it's still better than what most traditional published authors might get for an advance. So, you know, you can, I mean, that book was, it was my first book for a while. And then I had obviously some more, and then I got into writing fiction. So yeah, I tend to do both. And what's interesting is, you know, there's new people coming into this all the time. What it has changed in the last year or two is that we've really seen a lot of traditionally published mid-list authors coming into sort of the, you know, doing independent publishing, either for those other rights like we were talking about, or for their new work, because the mid-list is really being squeezed. You know, it's great for if you're a massive name, and it's fine if you're a debut, but for mid-list authors with, say, 5 to 10 books out, that's where the industry is really squeezing people income, and they're finding these other streams through self-publishing.
Right, which has kind of created what people call hybrid authors, who are sometimes publishing traditionally and other times publishing independently. Mm. So do you advise people, or do most people ask you whether they should start with ebook? Should they do ebook and print on demand, short run digital, or is it mostly for fiction going to be ebook only?
Oh, no, I always say, you know, why wouldn't you do a print on demand book? I mean, you know, firstly, all writers want to hold a book in their hands. and, you know, and the cost for doing print on demand is very small now, especially with a tool called Vellum. I don't know if you've heard of Vellum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have. Yeah, great. So if people don't know, Vellum, it is Mac only, but it's an incredible formatting tool that you can format beautiful ebooks. But in the last couple of months, it has expanded into print. And I've actually got next to me here the first, because I normally pay a professional formatter. And I was like, no, I've got to try Vellum print. And I've got the book here, and it looks great. So, I mean, that's another, you know, bit of a game changer, really. So you can do print very easily as well as ebook now. So I definitely advise people to do both, even very short books now. So I do novellas in print, and also box sets I've started doing in print. I used to do them ebook only, but now you can put 3 books into one big print product. You know, why not? You can do hardbacks with Ingram Spark. There's all kinds of things you can do with print on demand that generally just involve either paying a designer to do, you know, the print layout, or using some of the options online. I generally advise people to get a professional cover done.
Yes, you know, absolutely. I think that's
really important. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, we say that, but what's interesting, there are so many designers now who do these sort of, I can't remember what they call them, but they design sort of 100 covers, and then they put them up for sale at like $20 each. So I know a lot of people who buy the cover and then write a book for the cover, which I think is really cool. So yeah, I definitely advise both.
Right. And there are companies, another company that does book production kind of online is called Pressbooks, based in Montreal. And then there are all these, I find it amazing. I do think you know, unless you're a graphic artist yourself and you've done book covers, it is always better to hire somebody professional. But there are, as you said, there are so many resources, and there are, you know, the websites for freelancers where you can hire a freelance cover designer, and you can look at their portfolio, see which ones they've done that you like, and pay them. And, you know, you can get a book cover for $100 now.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I mean, there are so many freelancers who are so professional. And I think the quality, that's another thing that's changed since I started in self-publishing. You know, the first 99-cent ebooks on Kindle really had some very bad covers. But now, most independent authors who are making decent money at this all use professional covers. I mean, many romance authors who are, you know, the 6, 7, 8-figure authors I know, they have their own photo shoots. You know, it's a really right. serious thing now.
Well, it makes sense. And if, you know, the cover is, when you're thinking about how books are sold, and it's, if you're thinking about the majority of them being sold online, what sells the book? How do you see the book? You're browsing book covers. So it has to be, I think you have to have a cover that people understand kind of inherently in less than a nanosecond almost. You know, they're really, you have to grab people's attention in such a short amount of time, in such a small size. The cover is really important.
Oh, definitely. It's probably the number one marketing asset you have. People don't think of a book cover as marketing. They think of it as production, but it's also, you know, it will be the basis of your book marketing too. And the other thing I would say is, you know, one of the nice things about being an independent author is the freedom to change your cover. I mean, I've changed some of my covers several times. I've changed my book titles. You know, if things are, and of course, traditional publishers do this all the time, changing book covers, you know, happens to rebrand authors and things. So, you know, if things aren't working, it's not a huge deal to change up the cover, you know, change your series covers and just start again.
No, that makes sense. And in fact, that's true because certainly for ebooks and even with digital short run printing, it's not like you have 5,000 books sitting in the warehouse that you have to throw away because you want to put a new cover on them.
Absolutely. And I just don't hold stock at all. So all of my books are print on demand. I love it. It's amazing. You just get profit. This is the thing. If people don't understand, you know, you don't have to pay for the run. Someone orders a book, it's printed, sent to the customer, and you get some money, which is just an awesome business model.
A little bit of magic for authors. Well, you touched a little bit on marketing, and you know, it's a huge subject. We will not have time to cover in any great detail, but do you find, this is maybe it's a loaded question, but, or a leading question. I think that marketing is so important to writers and yet is so difficult for so many writers to get their arms around. And even when they read in books about marketing and they go to conferences and they talk to people like you, they often find it really daunting. And I wonder if, and also because it changes, you know, marketing techniques change, technology changes, the landscape changes. How do you advise writers on marketing in an environment of such constant change and so many challenges?
Yeah, it's a big question. I actually just released the third edition of my book, How to Market a Book, which obviously goes into this in huge detail. It's one of my longest books, which is kind of crazy. But I think what's interesting, because I've learned more about marketing over the years, and many people write nonfiction because they need to actually learn this stuff themselves. And I think there are principles that underpin all of the new technology that comes out there. And one of the principles I like to come back to with creative people is to say that, you know, marketing is not going buy my book and sort of spamming people on Twitter. It's about sharing what you love with people who want to hear about it. So, you know, you and I are talking about publishing to people who are interested in listening to a show about publishing. You know, there are not people listening left anymore who aren't interested in this topic. And I feel the same way with any kind of marketing. So for my I write thrillers under JF Penn, that's F for Francis. And I share a lot of pictures of graveyards now because I'm a taphophile. I like graveyards. Now, some people listening will be like, oh, great, I like graveyards too. And those people might be interested in my fiction. But there are another group of people listening who think I'm weird. So when I share a picture of a graveyard that I'm visiting on Twitter or on my Facebook page for JF Penn, some people are going to like it. Or tattoos. Like I really love, really interesting tattoos. I write a lot about them and I share pictures of those. Again, if you're not interested, you're not going to click. You're not going to follow me. But if you are, you might click through. You might see that I've got a book that has a character with tattoos or that a lot of my books have graveyards in, and you might actually follow me. So you can see that sharing a picture of a graveyard is not saying buy my book. It's actually drawing people in. It's attracting people. So that's my fundamental thing is by sharing things that you love, sharing things that are around the themes of your book, whether you're fiction or nonfiction, you will attract an audience who will value those things. And then if you use paid advertising, the same principle applies because you're going to be doing paid ads to people who are interested in those things. So that's the sort of principle that underpins everything in marketing. It's thinking about the customer and then sharing things that will attract the customer who will enjoy your book.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. It is kind of the antidote to the old fashioned marketing, which I call megaphone marketing. You know, the just yell as loudly as possible about your product, thinking that that is what's going to get people's attention does not work.
Yeah,
you have to get people to engage. And I think that people do engage with the kind of elements of a person's book or the element of your story, if you give them the chance to find out who you are.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in this very noisy environment where there are so many books being published and also, let's face it, so much good stuff on Netflix, in order to get people's attention and to enable them to care about us, we have to be putting some of this stuff out there. That's why I like podcast interviews, because if people have listened, people will tune in every week to listen to you and my show, the same thing with me. And then with these interviews, people get a chance to listen to your voice. And, we're humans, voice means a lot. We connect with people through our voice and our expression and, that type of thing. So it's really important to put yourself out there in authentic ways where people can actually connect with you as a human being, and then they might be interested in buying your book. But I think the relationship has to last longer than, a quick tweet.
Yeah, no, I think you're giving good advice, and clearly I need to buy your book. So that's one thing I've learned from talking to you is that I want to buy your book about book marketing. So I will do that. And I think that it will be, I think I will learn something. So I appreciate that.
Oh, my evil plan is working.
Yeah, exactly. you buy one customer at a time by talking to them for 40 minutes. That's not a good business model. But no, just all joking aside, I think that clearly you have a lot of good advice to give, and I really appreciate your spending the time to talk with me here. So thanks for doing this.
Oh, no worries. And if people are interested, my podcast is The Creative Pen with a double N podcast. And I also have a lot of free information at thecreativepen.com, pen with a double N. So, and I am on Twitter a lot at The Creative Pen if people do have questions.
No, that's great. And your website is just a remarkable repository of information. It's easy to spend a lot of time there, probably. It just is a warning to anybody, if you have some time available before you visit the Creative Pen, because it's really, there's a lot there. So.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me, David. That was a great, great chat.
Thank you, Joanna. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Joanna Penn of the Creative Pen. Thanks.